Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Support for WPR comes from Ulbrich Botanical Gardens, home to 16 acres of Midwest Hardy display gardens, located at 3330 Atwood Avenue in Madison. Open daily from 10 to 6. Ulbrich.org.
Truck tore out 40 foot of barbed wire. He made the sign of the cross and he kept the hammer down. He was ripping through the wheat, there were tears on his cheeks. By the time he shut her down, he was 40 acres deep.
Longtime fans of Wisconsin author Michael Perry are used to his easy humor and homespun style, but his latest release, a novella entitled 40 Acres Deep, is a departure from his usual work, this time delving into the mental health challenges of a fictional farmer struggling through one difficulty after another, including the death of his wife. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we take a deep dive into the inspiration for Perry's book, 40 Acres Deep, and the serious mental health challenges that are so pervasive in Wisconsin's agricultural communities. Join in this discussion at 800-780-9742 or send questions and perspectives to ideas at WPR.org. Michael Perry is a national best-selling author, humorist, singer-songwriter, and playwright from New Auburn, Wisconsin. He also produces the popular audio newsletter Michael Perry's Voicemail and hosts the nationally syndicated Tent Show Radio. He lives in rural Wisconsin with his family. Michael, welcome to Route 51.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Joy Kirkpatrick is an outreach specialist for the University of Wisconsin's Madison's Center for Dairy Profitability, who meets with farmers to help them navigate farm succession planning. She has extensive experience working with farm businesses and farm families on some of their most personal issues. She is also a certified adult mental health first aid trainer. Joy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Michael, this book feels like a big departure in style from your previous work, but it also feels really personal to you. So when did you first start to feel this story coming to you?
A handful of winters ago, we had intense snowfall. It seemed like it just never stopped all winter long. And we live on an old farmstead. I have two pole barns, and they were, as far as I could tell, in danger of collapsing. And so I started going back and forth between them, trying to save them, clear the roofs. And I was up at 2 in the morning, struggling between them, dragging a torpedo heater, trying to melt some of the snow. And they were so big and so deep, it couldn't be done by hand. And I was cussing and sweating and worrying about losing those sheds, when all of a sudden it hit me that if my two sheds went down, I'm a self-employed writer. I'd lose some junk. Mm-hmm. But if some of my neighbor sheds went down, and indeed in the end they did, many sheds right in my neighborhood, and then later that winter when I would drive across the state, I would see sheds and barns down all over the place. If their sheds go down, they would lose cattle, they'd lose their livelihood, and in a couple of cases, their own lives. And so I think that planted the seed of the idea of the struggle, that I was actually feeling it and experiencing it physically. But then I tried to extrapolate from that experience into what it would be like to actually be fighting to save a farm as a farmer. And so that cogitated for a while, and then there was a couple winters ago, we didn't get to go much of anywhere, and I was holed up in my little farmhouse mm-hmm. or my little room above the garage where I write, and I think the time felt right, and I just started hammering on that and looking at the people who raised me that went through this, looking at the people who are going through it now, and then looking at myself, too, and my shortcomings and failings, and trying to roll them all into this one character, Harold, the farmer.
Joy, when you first read this book, who did you see reflected in its pages?
Oh, It's a lot of farmers that I've worked with. I could definitely pick some of their characteristics, and I can see that in Harold. And my dad, I grew up on a farm in southern Illinois, and I definitely could see some parallels with his life and things that happened as we were growing up as kids, and seeing the struggles that he and my mom went through with farming and trying to maybe hold it in a little more than maybe he should have.
Michael, what about you? Who is the main character, Harold, to you? Is he modeled after any one person, or how much of yourself do you see in Harold?
Well, as far as the farmer part of Harold, he is not patterned on any one particular person. He's patterned on the many men and women I've watched over the last four decades of my recollection that have gone through similar things. So that's the starting point. Some of his failings and some of the things he's most ruthless about when he looks in the mirror, literally and figuratively, in this book, those are for me. I mean, it was a chance to really examine my own shortcomings and behavior as, you know, as a husband, as a father, as a citizen. And so I just thought, I write memoir mostly. And in my memoir, I try to be honest about myself and about those I'm writing about. But I also don't try to just take a cudgel to anybody.
Right.
And I try to make it poetic. And in this case, since I was writing fiction and the novella form, which is very short, I just thought, you know what? Let's just strip away all the varnish and just lay it all out there. And I was nervous about that. I didn't know how people would react, but it seems to have been the right decision.
I can really hear your voice in this story, much the same as I have in your other books. There is some humor here, after all, but I mean, even though it's a really serious subject, how hard was it for you to go this route? How emotionally taxing was this process for you?
Well, I absolutely went to those dark places, and I inhabit those dark places myself. I wrote a book called Montaigne in Barn Boots, which is about French philosophy from the standpoint of someone who grew up cleaning calf pens. And I have chapters in there, like I have a chapter called Shame, where I've been pretty heartless looking at myself. And I wrote about anxiety and panic attacks, and I wrote about, I have a brother who's a logger, and I was talking about anxiety. And, you know, you look at a logger, and they're supposed to just be tough, and he is tough. He could kick the slats out of me, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have emotional struggles. And so I think with this particular character, I was just trying to get at those things very honestly and bluntly and without any cushion. On the other hand, those very same people who raised me, these very same farmers that I've watched go through this, there is a particular strain of dark humor that I did allow to come into the book, because you do need a little relief. And I think the quick example I'd give is that it has been my contention that the American literary scene has largely neglected the torpedo heater as a subject of consideration. And so torpedo heaters are a very central part of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite moment, if I can pick my own favorite moment,
yeah,
is when Harold, he's setting up this torpedo heater. He's trying to melt the snow off the roof. And he starts it up, and then he looks at the warning that says, "Never leave your torpedo heater unattended." And he says, "Huh," and walks to the house.
Yeah. I remember that part of the book.
And that, I think, says a lot about the folks who raised me. They're like, I'll be careful, but I ain't going to be that careful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the recurring themes in this book to me is Harold's kind of inability to really adapt to this new world around him. There's a scene where someone asks him if he takes Apple Pay, for example. He's like, "What?" I guess, Joy, is this kind of resistance to change a common theme with the farmers you work with?
I think it's variable. I wouldn't say I think there has to be a really compelling reason if things are working for them, right? And when we think about farmers, we want them to be kind of consistent, right? We want them to be able to consistently be milking those cows in a timely fashion, and we want them to have that consistency. But we're also, at the same time, asking them to be a part of this ever-changing technology and world, and make those changes and come along with them, come along with those kinds of things. So I think that's the part where we have an expectation for something to be really consistent, but we also want them to be like on board with all of this technology. So I think there's a struggle there sometimes.
And I think I would just jump in to say that I tried to address that by not stereotyping Harold either as just someone who just resists all change, because actually
right.
the book opens with him considering the fact that he wants to be open to change. He knows he needs to yeah. adapt. It's just that at some point the pace becomes such that you feel like you're trying to swim upriver in a
yeah.
flood.
I think farmers are adapting to technology way more than maybe the general public realizes because of all of the things that they're doing to keep their farms up to date and improving and progressing. It's just some of the other technology changes that they may not see as necessary that we see on the surface. We might stereotype them as resistant to change, but farmers are resilient and adaptable, especially within their business model.
And they play a kind of a balancing act between what has worked for centuries and what needs to change and what is
yeah.
different. Michael,
yeah.
I'm not going to give away the ending of the book, but even in its bleak subject matter, there seems to be a glimmer of hope. What do you want readers to feel when they turn that last page?
Well, I don't want to give anybody false hope, but I do. Again, I turn to myself. I get pretty dark some days, but what's the point if you're just going to surrender to that darkness? And I even want to be careful how I frame that, because that can be insulting to say that you've surrendered to darkness. None of us know the struggles, internal and external, that people around us are facing, and so I don't mean to frame it as a form of weakness. I just mean that in my own case, when I get to my darkest about the state of things, I also realize, well, my kids need me to lift my eyes up and look to the horizon and do the best I can. And again, that comes back, if there's a note of hope in the book, it gets back to what we were just talking about, that in my own life, I've watched so many of my beloved mentors and elders, the people who gave me this wonderful foundation and security, and yet in the last years of their life, they turned very brittle and bitter. And I just want to avoid that. I don't want to try to be the hip old guy. That's not what I'm, it's not like, hey, kids,
mm-hmm.
that's horrifying. But I do want to be the person that finds this blend of holding on to the things from the past that did make me solid, but being open to new ways and new people. And I hope that's what the last note of the book provides.
What has the reaction been like from your readers and your fans?
We are surprised and gratified. I was pretty tentative about putting this book out. And to be clear, part of the reason I was tentative is because it is unsparing. It is not the way I've been putting it is there's not a lot of zippity-doo-dah in this book. So I was nervous about that. I was nervous about, in order for me to write honestly, this character has to say things that I've had a couple of notes from people objecting to the language, and all I can say respectfully to them is, if you've ever witnessed someone going through something like this and you object to the language they use, I don't think you're paying attention to the bigger picture. But I think the biggest concern I had about this book is that I don't want to be perceived as leveraging the real struggle of real people. I make no secret about the fact that I'm self-employed. I write for a living, you know, and that's how I pay for the kids' braces in college,
mm-hmm.
is selling books. But in this particular case, in an odd way, that pressure was off me, because my agent took this to some of the bigger publishers, and they weren't interested. And that's not a negative comment. It just doesn't fit their model, and they think that there's not an audience for this stuff. And so I said, that's cool. I started out publishing my own books. I'll do this one myself. And so we did it ourselves, and it's already into its second printing. It's selling just steadily. It's not, you know, climbing any charts or anything like that. But I just today looked at, we're probably going to have to print some more. So I would say that the reaction is quietly solid.
You're hearing Michael Perry and Joy Kirkpatrick. They're with us today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on Michael's latest book, 40 Acres Deep and Farmer Mental Health. Ahead, we'll hear about some specific resources available for farmers struggling with mental health challenges and more about a panel discussion coming up later this month on this very subject. Join in this discussion at 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seewert. We continue our discussion of the mental health challenges specific to the farming community and how this issue is portrayed in Michael Perry's latest book. It's called 40 Acres Deep. Michael stays with us along with Joy Kirkpatrick. You can call in with your questions too, 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. Joy, you're both appearing in a panel discussion later this month. How did the two of you connect on this subject, and how did this panel discussion come to be?
Well, Michael's been I work for the University of Wisconsin, as you noted, with the Division of Extension. And Michael has been at some of our Extension meetings over the years, and so I've gotten to know Michael through that. He also came to a Spring Green Literary Festival when we were hosting those several years ago, and that's where I live. And so we've known each other, sort of professionally through that kind of work. And so he, when he wrote this book, he asked me to be one of the first readers, and I was able to give some feedback and encourage him to get this published. And from there, I knew as soon as I read it that I wanted to figure out a way to have Michael here and have a farmer panel to react to the novella and also talk about mental health issues or challenges in the farming community. And I've been working in that space since probably fairly steadily since about 2016, but over the years of my career in extension, have been doing several kinds of educational programs and building awareness around resources and ways to help support farmer well-being.
So what's going to happen at the panel? There will be how many farmers will be participating? And I guess, Michael, what do you want people to come away with when they attend?
Well, I think part of that event will be to hear their voices. It's all well and good for me to write a fictional book from the heart and from my observations and some personal experience, but nothing replaces the testimony of people who are actually standing with their feet in the dirt.
Well, clinical depression is a major concern for people in the agricultural industry, especially farmers, as we've discussed here. Joy, I read a report from March that said suicide rates are significantly higher within the rural and agricultural communities. I mean, significantly higher. So talk a little bit about some of the factors that have led to that reality.
Yeah. So there's been some research that has surveyed farmers. We've done some focus group with farmers, and there are a variety of things, right? It's not all of the same for every farmer. So these are just a few things that may be the pressures, what we kind of call pressures that build, and it can be very much tied to perhaps prices of commodities or prices of their products that they're selling, prices of the inputs that they're using. So there's always sort of an overlying financial component with that, be it an individual financial situation or that bigger market piece can also have some pressure with that. And we've just seen over the years, you know, I did some of this work in 2012 when there was a drought, some of this work in 2009 through about 2011 when the milk prices fell drastically. And then we've just, it feel like the cycles are quicker and more dramatic when we think about the market prices and that financial component. So that's always something that's sort of overriding on with all kinds of farms. So the profit margins are just tighter and tighter, and the expectations of keeping up with the modernization and trying to build size is a lot of pressure.
Michael, yeah. Michael, in your book, it's very personal about Harold, but I mean, how much of these factors that Joy is talking about played out in the way you plotted the book?
Well, it's playing out everywhere. I mean, it's that constant balance between the, you know, even the definition of a small farmer. And that's an area that I'm not even equipped to get into because that definition is flexible. And as we talked about earlier, how much of the new do you take on? How much do you scale up? And it's an individual decision that's being made thousands of times a day all across the U.S. I mean, social media is horrifying a lot of the time.
Yes.
But it's also a way to tune in to people who aren't otherwise being heard, and I've done that in several areas. But one of the areas is over the past couple of years, just following all different sorts of farmers from all over the U.S. on Twitter, and they are not in lockstep. They are not in agreement. They have their own internal controversies and battles. But there is this thread of independence, and there is this thread of each person trying to make the right decision for their situation and their farm. And so I'm seeing that around, of course. And in some ways, there are resurgences I'm seeing of small operators and cultivating an audience, just like I might cultivate an audience for my books. And then on the other hand, there are folks who are just trying to adapt to the future and scale up. But in the end, it is this unique profession where you have in the mix this deep, deep tie to the land and sometimes to the animals you're working with. And so I think there's an emotional component to farming that is hard to replicate anywhere else and really hard to replace if you're looking at giving it up.
Yeah, I think that's something that we see when I work with with farm succession and farm transition. That legacy piece can put a lot of pressure. You maybe have someone that maybe within your family that wants to take over, and there's a pressure there. And then, or maybe you don't, right? And there's an idea of if this land has been in their family and in the family name for generations, what happens there? I think that there's a struggle there. And both, even though you may have someone who's willing to step in and be a successor, for that owner generation, the idea of not being the farmer, right? The identity piece that we have around farming and what are you if you aren't the farmer, I think is very much an emotional component that a lot of farmers may not feel comfortable expressing, but we know it's there.
Joy, I want to talk about mental health first aid. UW Extension began holding these virtual mental health first aid sessions last year. What is that all about, and what do you mean by mental health first aid?
So mental health first aid is kind of compare it to CPR, right? It's not, it's more, that training is not intended for people to be able to become therapists. Obviously, it's an 8-hour program, but it's a way to equip people to notice things, engage in a conversation with someone that may be experiencing some challenges, and then having them be equipped with resources to help them help connect the person with the challenge with resources that are necessary. Sometimes, you know, it may be a crisis situation where that you need to call in 911 or something like that. But a lot of times it's maybe not quite to that level. And if we can engage with people in conversations and get them connected to resources earlier, the outcomes are better. And so that's the idea, is that we equip mental health first aid, and we have a couple other behavioral health programs that are being taught through extension educators. My idea is that while we may not teach this directly to farmers, but we want to teach it to so many people in the rural communities. The farmers are surrounded by people who can support them and get them to resources, even if the farmer themselves may not be recognizing that there are some changes that are happening.
One of the things that stands out to me as a reader is that there are trigger warnings in the opening pages of the book for references to suicide and infant death, and it points to the full list of resources in the book's final pages. Michael, why did you make the decision to include this? Was it kind of a mental health first aid for the readers of this book, or even for you?
Definitely for the readers. There are blunt discussions of very difficult topics in this book that I didn't want someone to stumble upon. And if you see that first page and you decide I don't need to relive that, I've had some family members who have gone through these things, and I know that sometimes it helps to talk, sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it certainly doesn't help to revisit, and certainly not without some sort of context or warning. So in this case, I just put a very simple statement at the beginning of the book, and then we did put resources at the end. And this is one of those rare times. I don't usually, when I write a book, my editor sees it, copy editors see it. Occasionally, I fact-check things with my wife, because she likes to know if she's going to show up in a book ahead of time. But in this case, it's a rare time where I actually sent it out. I sent it to some farmers. I sent it to Joy, as she already mentioned. It was one of those cases where I wasn't looking for someone to tell me whether they thought the book was good or bad. I just wanted to find out how it felt to read it by someone who doesn't spend most of his day typing. And that was of a great help to me. And that also just reinforced my desire that there be some resources in the book as well.
We have Leslie from the Northwoods with us now, who works with some farmers overseas. Leslie, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Now, I just caught this. It's really interesting what you're doing, Michael, because I've been for 18 years, I worked in the field of food and water security, which also includes nutrition, and I did not grow up on a farm, and I'm well-educated. The education that I have learned is from the farmers themselves. And one of the most important points that you just made is about what I see as this common connection or threads, that there's no voice. We never ask them what they need. I've worked with the United Nations and FAO. I've worked with small organizations. You know, we're well-intended. We come in, you know, with what we think is good for them. And you were talking about the technology, and never stop to think about, you know, you have to spend time, right? And especially in rural communities, it doesn't matter whether you're up here in the North Woods in a rural community. I work in Afghanistan. I work in Kenya. I work in Cambodia. You have to be able to spend the time and get to know people. And by doing that, you really get you get to hear their voices and who they are and how important it is. And instead of this dismissal of rural, you can tell them upset. Rural communities and farmers. And I've learned so much, you know, the so-called uneducated, and you can hear my voice because I've spent so many years with these farmers, and they're like, I say, the salt of the earth. I mean, I've learned so much from them, and I've learned how to be humble and to check myself before I, like, you know, go into a community, wherever it is, And it's been a source of growth for me, and this connection and awareness that I didn't know if I had not, you know, put myself in this position. And I just wanted to share this with you, because they end up sort of being pawns in the politics and the so-called well-intentioned and all the technology. And it's like, who are we to just slam this on them? I mean, we're humans, right? Nobody likes to be told what to do, and you do a little bit at a time. And that connection with the rural community, and they're very humble people. They don't go around bragging about themselves. That's another common thread I've seen everywhere in the world.
So I think
here in the U.S.
this reminds me of Sturgill Simpson, who I credit in as giving me the courage to write this book. Singer-songwriter, and one of his first early albums, and I'm going to blank on the name of the song, but he's from coal mining country. And he has a song about coal mining and what it has done to where he grew up, and it's told from the point of view of a local. And I love that song because for the first couple of verses, the local is talking about how the coal mining company has come in and destroyed their town and their mountains. But then in, like, I think about the third verse, the outsiders show up to save him from the coal company. And he says, go back to where you came from, we'll handle this. And I think that there's a little bit of that in my upbringing. I knee-jerk back to that farmer identity. I'm a soft-handed writer, but I think of what I do in terms of farming. And I do think that you've definitely put your finger on something that none of us like to be talked to. We want to be talked with.
Yes.
Great point. Thank you so much, Leslie. I really appreciate you calling in and sharing that with us. Michael, was there anything about writing this book that made you uncomfortable in a way that you aren't usually?
Not really. It was kind of the opposite. It was freeing. I knew that since there was nothing on the line, I didn't get an advance to write this book. I didn't sign a contract to write this book. I just had the opportunity to write whatever I wanted. And also, it allowed me to go back. So many times when I was writing this book, I felt like the long-haired, not bald poet guy who went to the coffee shop in the early 90s and just poured his heart out and wrote everything he was feeling. And in those times, it resulted in some pretty awful poetry. But there were things in this book, for all the darkness, there were also scenes, like I just was dying to write about snow and winter and hoarfrost and I was allowed to do that in this book. So honestly, no, other than the trepidations about how it might be received, it felt good to write it.
Were you worried that it might be received in a way that, like Leslie said, that an outsider knows how to solve the problems?
Well, that's what I said earlier. Yeah, I just didn't want to look like I was leveraging someone else's tragedy. That's a tricky balance.
Yeah. Michael Perry and Joy Kirkpatrick are with us today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion of mental health challenges in Wisconsin's farming community. Michael's new book is entitled 40 Acres Deep. Join in at 800-780-9742 or send your questions and comments to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guests, Joy Kirkpatrick, and Wisconsin author Michael Perry. You can join in our discussion on mental health challenges within the farming community at 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. Joy, I wanted to give you a moment to react to what Leslie was sharing with us earlier on the phone.
Yeah.
What did you think about what she was communicating with us?
I agree with Leslie's perspective of we need to make sure that, being a part of Extension, the university, for 30 years, you have to definitely build that trust to, you know, I think it's a Teddy Roosevelt, right? They need a quote, they need to know that you care before they care how much you know. So thinking about how that's my perspective of working with farms on succession planning for the past 20 to 30 years. That's definitely something that you learn how to do, build that trust, and make sure that whatever it is that family sees as their vision for that farm. While you want to give some sort of information and education and guidance so that they have the absolute best, make the best informed decision that they can, you also need to step back knowing that they know what's best for their family. So helping them get to those steps that's best for their farm and their family is definitely what I try to do when I work with farms. And so, yes, I appreciate Leslie's. And you know, hers is overseas. Her work is with farmers overseas. But I think that's that human component that isn't much different from country to state to whatever.
You know, Michael, you've clearly written this book for a very specific community. Use your skill of saying the things that maybe some folks don't always know how to say, but how much of Harold's character and his struggles do you think resonate with people outside the farming community?
Oh, gosh. I've got a whole collection of emails from folks who aren't farmers, and I think of a couple. I'll tell you what. I've gotten a lot of emails from husbands saying that this forced them to admit some things and to look at some things in themselves that they're not entirely comfortable with. And so I think that was a surprise. And, yeah, I think that's the one I would lead with. And then just based on the general sales and comments and reviews, it's definitely finding an audience outside the farming community, which I would hope, because that gets back again to what we were just talking about with the caller, that you do want folks from the outside to understand a little more about what this struggle is really like for a lot of these folks.
Joy, there are some ongoing economic conditions in agriculture that are really taking a toll on farm families. We touched on that a little bit earlier. I'm curious about your organization. How is the University of Wisconsin helping farmers remain resilient and deal with all of the stress? What kinds of programs are out there?
Well, I'm going to start broad and then go into programs. So for the university extension, you know, it's sort of that Wisconsin, or the Wisconsin idea of we develop research and try to bring research to people so that they can, again, make the best informed decisions for all the different aspects of their farm, whether that's crop decisions, livestock decisions. For narrowing it down to a bit more particular about farmer mental health, farmer well-being, we do some programs that we're actually going to roll it out this winter, is helping farms we're calling it navigating your ag business from stress to success. So helping them analyze where they are now, where do they want to be, and how do they get there. So it's very much helping them focus on the things that they want to work on right then, and us helping them with a framework and accountability to kind of walk through those steps that they need to make to get to that vision that they've set for themselves. So the research shows that planning can help give people peace of mind, and they also gives them a framework to be able to identify those new technologies, identify those new enterprises better and evaluate them better, because they can evaluate it against a framework of does that fit their vision, and does that fit the goals that they want for their farm and their family. So that's a program that we're offering this winter to help farms be in a cohort of group of other farmers to help develop their plans.
Do you find that farmers are reluctant to reach out, or is that really not the case, Joy?
You know, it's hard. There, you know, extension's not mandatory for anybody to interact with us. So the people who reach out to us are motivated in some ways. So I think that is a hard thing for me to answer perspective from that. I do feel like farmers in general feel very much that they need to fix things on their own. They do that within the context of the physical farm labor, right, that they have to be kind of a jack of all trades a lot of times, and so they're used to being the ones who are the fixers. And to reach out and admit that, especially in the area of mental health, that they may need help can be hard. I think that's getting better. I think there are the programs, there are all kinds of people working in this area now. And I think having these conversations helps reduce that stigma. But I do think that there's still a little work to be had for them to know that reaching out to have help with planning for their future of their farm, reaching out to help with if they need help with medical issues or mental health issues, I think we need to build that support and show that that's okay to ask for that help.
Michael, how important is community to emotional well-being for farmers?
Oh, I think it's pretty important, and based on my experience, we're not real good at it. And I just say we, just because, again, I'm a writer with soft hands, but I was raised a farm kid, grew up milking cows, baling hay, worked 5 years on a ranch in Wyoming to put myself through college. So that's my background. And to this day, I'm very much a loner. I spend most of my time alone in a tiny room writing books and trying to come up with the next idea. And I like it there, and it meshes well with a sense of stubborn independence. And again, I want to be careful, as Joy just pointed out, there are changes, and there are new generations getting into farming, so I don't want to stereotype either. But just based on my own experience, it does tend to create a certain independence and stubbornness. And part of that is I will be on my own for a long, long time, and the example I always give is my wife will say so-and-so, I thought I'd invite them over for the evening, and I'm like, no, I really don't. I want to be alone. I got this stuff to do, and I just really can't. And then those folks come over, and they leave after a wonderful evening of conversation and connection, and you feel refreshed and reconnected, and you realize I'm just an idiot. And so I do think community is important, but Joy gets this. I love the Roosevelt quote you used, because you can't just set up some cute little club and encourage folks to come and put their happy face on. It has to grow over time. The example I give, I truly am a loner, but I'm a member of the local volunteer rescue service, and I make a literal handful of calls at this point in my life. But for over 30 years, I've been part of the EMS community. And that has been so important to me, because no matter where I go, there's some group of people that I can sit down to, and we can converse in a language that only we understand. And I connect with them in a way that I don't, say, at a writer's group. And so I think that that's important for all of us, even if it is just occasional and fairly specific and small.
Joy, what do you think people within and outside of the farming community can take away from the themes of this book?
I think that in some ways, within the farming community, I think that any time that we can recognize they see something of themselves or their struggles in literature or in work, in those sorts of things, it helps them realize that they're being seen, right? That someone has seen the struggle or can identify in some sort of way. As Michael has said, we don't know what anybody's going through at any moment. We can't say that we know exactly what's happening, but to see a glimmer of something that you've experienced in a book, in any sort of story or movie, really does help people know that people see that struggle. I think an unbelievable number of times when we've done programs and farmers have come together and talked about something that maybe they haven't talked about in public away from their family before, the lift off of their shoulders of knowing that other people are dealing with those same issues is you can just see it physically when they've had an opportunity to talk about that. So anytime that they can feel seen and heard is important. outside of the community, I think that we need to know, and I grew up on a farm too, so it's hard for me to say outside of the farming community, but the general public needs to understand that farmers are trying to do all the right things and are trying to also survive in a economic sort of part that's difficult, right? So I think just understanding that people, farmers for the most part are trying to do the best they can, and kind of step back and give some people some grace when they think about where their food's coming from is an important piece too.
Michael, you write a lot of memoir. But what sorts of truth do you think you can say with fiction that maybe you can't with your essays?
Well, I would circle back to, I think, an earlier comment I made that I can be more ruthless because I know that I'm not, nobody can look at a piece of fiction and go, oh, you're actually talking about so-and-so. Whereas it's much harder. Actually, I kind of got that backwards, but in memoir, people know exactly who you're writing about. Mm-hmm. And so I can be honest, and there are ways to deal with difficult issues in memoir and nonfiction. But with fiction, I wrote another book, a humorous novel called The Jesus Cow, and there were just things that I wanted to say and express that I thought, A, needed to be cushioned in humor, but B, didn't really fit into a nonfiction setting. So I think fiction in some ways is freeing, although for years I have maintained it's much harder to, I actually get more flack from fiction than I do nonfiction. Because again, in nonfiction, you can go, okay, that's Bob. I might have changed his name, but we all know who that really is. Whereas when you write fiction and, I'm going to pick on my poor mom. So let's say I write a mom character who's, somehow difficult. And then you get a call from your mom going, why do you think I was difficult? They go, no, it's fiction. Oh, no, I can tell. And by the way, my mom did not do this to me, but I'm using her as an example. So I don't know. I think, though, as far as some of the more dark things that I addressed, I was able to just be unsparing on this character because he is, after all, fictional. So I'm not hurting a real person when I do that. I was going to mention, too, that we have focused on a lot of the dark things, but Joy reminded me when you and in our discussion of finding community and understanding each other, one of the things that I love, I've spoken at some of those farmer get-togethers that Joy references, and one of my favorite things, I have a line, I came up with it a million years ago, it should be worn out by now, but it's not, and it's just, never stand behind a sneezing cow. And I love telling that story, and I especially love telling it at farm get-togethers because I've learned over the last 20 years that line gets a laugh in big cities, it gets a laugh in the South, it gets a laugh in the North. People get it, but the laugh that you get when you tell it to a group of farmers is what I call the laugh of recognition. They all just look at each other and nod, and I love making those sort of connections that even as, again, the third time I've said it, but as a soft-handed writer, I ran a pitchfork. I grew up on the wooden end of a pitchfork, and I spent just enough time there that I can still throw out a line where the farmers relate. And that too, again, I want to make sure that we reiterate there's humor in this life as well.
We have about a minute left in our time together. Michael, what are you working on next? What will inspire your next work?
What will inspire me is I've got one kid in braces and one kid in college, and I'm self-employed. Honestly, the best way for me to answer that question, I have a website, sneezingcow.com. And if you go to sneezingcow.com, the very first post there is a little summary, and it's I have two books under contract right now. There's information about the new book, and I'm on the road a lot with my band or speaking or performing little one-man humor shows, but none of it happens if I'm not sitting down at the desk in the morning as I did today and writing. Actually, in case anyone saw me in public, I have to be truthful. I sat down in a coffee shop this morning because I came to the big city to do this.
The big city. Yes. Well, I want to thank you both for spending your time with us today and sharing this with us. It was a really great conversation.
Thank you for having us. And Joy, thank you for joining me. You lent such substance to this discussion.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending once more a sincere thanks to our guests, Michael Perry and Joy Kirkpatrick. Our producers are Kate Spranger, Liz Harder, and Rick Ryer. Rick is also our executive producer and today's on-air producer. You can find links for mental health resources on our webpage, wpr.org/route51. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Michael Perry and the Longbeds, Jelly Roll, Jake Banfield, and Jason Isbell. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51 and on your favorite podcast platform. If you have an idea for a future program, get in touch by email, ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Until next week, we're headed out of town.
Open up my window and let the light come in. I step outside in the middle of the morning and in the evening again. Yes, I've tried.